all-powerful dirt. It was waste made instrument. It was their life together that was the cause of everything, their little meals that left skin peelings, dust from both of them that mingled everywhere. Every couple secretes these little bits of litter that must be destroyed to make space for new ones. What a life one spends, and to be able to go out with a fresh little shirt, attractive to passers-by, so your engineer husband looks good in his life. Mantras replayed in Marguerite's head. Take care of the wooden floors. For the care of brass, use... She was in charge of the care of two ordinary beings for the rest of their days. Note, on joue perdant, playing a losing game. Washing, ironing, sweeping, rooting out tufts of dust in the dark places behind the wardrobe, this is holding away death, but also refusing life. For in one movement, time is created and destroyed. The housewife only grasps the negative aspect of it. Hers is the attitude of a Manichaean. The essence of Manichaeism is not only to recognize two principles, one good and one evil, it is also to posit that good is attained by the abolition of evil, and not by a positive movement. In this sense, Christianity is hardly Manichaean, in spite of the existence of the devil, because it is in devoting oneself to God that one best fights the devil, and not in trying to conquer him. All doctrines of transcendence and freedom subordinate the defeat of evil to progress toward good. But the wife is not called to build a better world. The house, the bedroom, the dirty laundry, the wooden floors are fixed things. She can do no more than root out indefinitely the foul causes that creep in. She attacks the dust, stains, mud, and filth. She fights sin. She fights with Satan. But it is a sad destiny to have to repel an enemy without respite, instead of being turned toward positive aims. The housewife often submits to it in rage. Bachelard uses the word malice for it. Psychoanalysts have written about it. For them, housekeeping mania is a form of sadomasochism. It is characteristic of mania and vice to make freedom want what it does not want, because the maniacal housewife detests having negativity, dirt, and evil as her lot. She furiously pursues dust, accepting a condition that revolts her. She attacks life itself through the rubbish left from any living growth. Whenever a living being enters her sphere, her eye shines with a wicked fire. Wipe your feet! Don't mess up everything. Don't touch that. She would like to stop everyone from breathing. The least breath is a threat. Every movement threatens her with more thankless work. A child's somersault is a tear to sew up. Seeing life as a promise of decomposition, demanding more endless work, she loses her joie de vivre. Her eyes sharpen. Her face looks preoccupied and serious. Always on guard, she protects herself through prudence and avarice. She closes the windows because sun would bring in insects, germs, and dust. Besides, the sun eats away at the silk wall coverings. The antique armchairs are hidden under loose covers and embalmed in mothballs. Light would fade them. She does not even care to let her visitors see these treasures. Admiration sullies. This defiance turns to bitterness and causes hostility to everything that lives. In the provinces, some bourgeois women have been known to put on white gloves to make sure no invisible dust remains on the furniture. These were the kinds of women the Papin sisters murdered several years ago. Their hatred of dirt was inseparable from their hatred of their servants, of the world, and of each other. Few women choose such a gloomy vice when they are young. Those who generously love life are protected from it. Colette tells us about Sido. The fact is that, though she was active and always on the go, she was not a sedulous housewife. She was clean and tidy, fastidious even, but without a trace of that solitary, maniacal spirit that counts napkins, lumps of sugar, and full bottles. With a flannel in her hands and one eye on the servant dawdling over her window cleaning and smiling at the man next door, she would utter nervous exclamations like impatient cries for freedom. When I take a lot of time and trouble wiping my Chinese cups, she would say, I can actually feel myself getting older. But she always persevered loyally until the job was finished. Then off she would go, down the two steps that led into the garden, and at once her resentment and her nervous exasperation subsided. Note, Sido, translation. It is in this nervousness and resentment that frigid or frustrated women, old maids, desperate housewives, and those condemned by their husbands to a solitary and empty existence are satisfied. I knew, among others, an elderly woman who woke up every morning at 5 o'clock to inspect the wardrobes and begin rearranging them. It seems that at 20 she was gay and coquettish, closed up in her isolated estate, with a husband who neglected her and a single child. She took to arranging, as others take to drink. For Elise, in The Bold Chronicle of a Strange Marriage, the taste for housework stems from the exasperated desire to rule the universe, from a living exuberance, and from a will for domination, which, for lack of an outlet, leads nowhere. It is also a challenge to time, the universe, life, men, and everything that exists. Since dinner from 9 o'clock onwards, she has been doing the washing. It is midnight. I have been dozing, but her fortitude annoys me because it insults my rest by making it look like laziness. Elise, if you want things to be clean, you shouldn't be afraid of getting your hands dirty first. And the house will soon be so spotless that we shall hardly dare live in it. There are divans, but you are expected to lie down beside them on the parquet floor. The cushions are too clean. You are afraid to soil or crumple them by putting your head or your feet on them, and every time I step on a carpet, I am followed with a carpet sweeper to remove the marks that I've made. In the evening, it's done. What is the point of her moving every object and every piece of furniture and going over all the floors, the walls, and the ceilings from the time she gets up till the time she goes to bed? For the moment, it is the housewife who is uppermost in her. Once she has dusted the insides of her cupboards, she dusts the geraniums on the windowsills. His mother. Elise always keeps so busy, she does not notice she is alive. Housework, in fact, allows the woman an indefinite escape far from herself. Chardin rightly remarks, here is a meticulous and disordered task, with neither stops nor limits. In the home, a woman certain to please quickly reaches her breaking point, a state of distraction and mental void that effaces her. Note, Jacques Chardin, L'Epithalam, Epithalamium, translation. This escape, this sadomasochism in which woman persists against both objects and self, is often precisely sexual. The kind of house cleaning that calls for bodily gymnastics amounts to a bordello for women, says Violette Leduc. Note, La Famée, The Starved Woman. It is striking that the taste for cleanliness is of utmost importance in Holland, where women are cold, and in puritanical civilizations that juxtapose the joys of the flesh with an ideal of order and purity. If the Mediterranean Midi lives in joyous filth, it is not only because water is scarce there. Love of the flesh and its animality is conducive to tolerating human odor, squalor, and even vermin. Preparing meals is more positive work and often more enjoyable than cleaning. First of all, it involves going to the market, which is, for many housewives, the best time of the day. The loneliness of the household weighs on the woman just as routine tasks leave her head empty. She is happy when, in Midi towns, she can sew, wash, and peel vegetables while chatting on her doorstep. Fetching water from the river is a grand adventure for half-cloistered Muslim women. I saw a little village in Kabyle where the women tore down the fountain an official had built on the plaza. Going down every morning to the wadi flowing at the foot of the hill was their only distraction. All the time they are doing their marketing, waiting in lines, in shops, on street corners, they talk about things that affirm their homemaking worth. from which each one draws the sense of her own importance. They feel part of a community that, for an instant, is opposed to the society of men as the essential to the inessential. But above all, making a purchase is a profound pleasure. It is a discovery, almost an invention. Gide observes in his journals that the Muslims, unfamiliar with games of chance, have replaced them with the discovery of hidden treasures. This is the poetry and adventure of mercantile civilizations. The housewife is oblivious to the gratuitousness of games, but a good firm cabbage and a ripe camembert are treasures that must be subtly discovered in spite of the cunning shopkeeper. Between seller and buyer, relations of dealing and ruse are established. For her, winning means getting the best goods for the lowest price. Concern for a restricted budget is not enough to explain the extreme importance given to being economical. Winning the game is what counts. When she suspiciously inspects the stalls, the housewife is queen. The world, with its riches and traps, is at her feet for her taking. She tastes a fleeting triumph when she empties her shopping basket on the table. She puts her canned food and non-perishables in the larder, guarding her against the future. And she contemplates with satisfaction the raw vegetables and meats she is about to submit to her power. Gas and electricity have killed the magic of fire, but in the countryside, many women still know the joys of kindling live flames from inert wood. With the fire lit, the woman changes into a sorceress. With a simple flip of the hand, beating the eggs or kneading the dough, or by the magic of fire, she affects transmutations of substances. Matter becomes food. Colette again describes the enchantment of this alchemy. All is mystery, magic, spell. All that takes place between the time the casserole, kettle, stewpot, and their contents are put on the fire, and the moment of sweet anxiety, a voluptuous expectation, when the dish is brought steaming to the table and its headdress removed. Among other things, she lovingly depicts the metamorphoses that take place in the secret of hot ashes. Wood ash does a flavorsome job of cooking whatever it is given to cook. The apple, the pear nestling among the ashes, come out wrinkled and smoke-tanned, but soft under the skin, like a mole's belly. And however bonne femme the apple cooked in the stove might be, it is a far cry from this jam enclosed in its original robe, thick with flavor, and, if you go about it right, has oozed but a single tear of honey. A tall three-legged cauldron held sifted ash that never saw the fire, but stuffed with potatoes lying side by side without touching, its black claws planted in the embers. The cauldron laid tubers for us white as snow, burning hot, flaky. Note, passage translated by Nina de Voogd Fuller. Translation. Women writers have particularly celebrated the poetry of making preserves. It is a grand undertaking, marrying pure solid sugar and the soft pulp of fruit in a copper preserving pan, foaming, viscous, boiling. The substance being made is dangerous. It is a bubbling lava the housewife proudly captures and pours into jars. When she covers them with parchment paper and inscribes the date of her victory, it is a triumph over time itself. She has captured the passage of time in the snare of sugar. She has put life in jars. Cooking is more than penetrating and revealing the intimacy of substances. It reshapes and recreates them. In working the dough, she experiences her power. The hand as well as the eye has its reveries and poetry, says Bachelard. Note, Gaston Bachelard, La Terre et les Rêveries de la Volonté, Earth and Reveries of Will. And he speaks of this suppleness that fills one's hands, rebounding endlessly from matter to hand and from hand to matter. The hand of the cook who kneads is a gratified hand, and cooking lends the dough a new value still. Cooking is thus a great material transformation from whiteness to golden brown, from dough to crust. Women can find a special satisfaction in a successful cake or a flaky pastry, because not everyone can do it. It takes a gift. Nothing is more complicated than the art of pastry, writes Michelet. Nothing proceeds less according to rule or is less dependent on education. One must be born with it. It is wholly a gift of the mother. Here again, it is clear that the little girl passionately enjoys imitating her female elders. With chalk and grass, she plays at make-believe. She is happier still when she has a real little oven to play with, or when her mother lets her come into the kitchen and roll out the pastry with her palms, or cut the hot burning caramel. But this is like housework. Repetition soon dispels these pleasures. For Indians who get their nourishment essentially from tortillas, the women spend half their days kneading, cooking, reheating, and kneading again identical tortillas under every roof, identical throughout the centuries. They are hardly sensitive to the magic of the oven. It is not possible to transform marketing into a treasure hunt every day, nor to delight in a shiny water tap. Women and men writers can lyrically exalt these triumphs because they never or rarely do housework. Done every day, this work becomes monotonous and mechanical. It is laden with waiting, waiting for the water to boil, for the roast to be cooked just right, for the laundry to dry. Even if different tasks are well organized, there are long moments of passivity and emptiness. Most of the time, they are accomplished in boredom. Between present life and the life of tomorrow, they are but an inessential intermediary. If the individual who executes them is himself a producer or creator, they are integrated into his existence as naturally as body functions. This is why everyday chores seem less dismal when performed by men. They represent for them only a negative and contingent moment they hurry to escape. But what makes the lot of the wife servant ungratifying is the division of labor that dooms her wholly to the general and inessential. Home and food are useful for life, but do not confer any meaning on it. The housekeeper's immediate goals are only means, not real ends, and they reflect no more than anonymous projects. It is understandable that to give meaning to her work, she endeavors to give it her individuality and to attach an absolute value to the results obtained. She has her rituals, her superstitions. She has her ways of setting the table, arranging the living room, mending, cooking a dish. She persuades herself that in her place, no one could make such a good roast or do the polishing as well. If her husband or daughter wants to help her or tries to do without her, she grabs the needle or the broom. You don't know how to sew a button. Dorothy Parker described with a pitying irony the dismay of a young woman convinced she should bring a personal note to the arrangement of her house, but not knowing how. Mrs. Ernest Weldon wandered about the orderly living room, giving it some of those little feminine touches. She was not especially good as a touch giver. The idea was pretty and appealing to her. Before she was married, she had dreamed of herself as moving softly about her new dwelling, deftly moving a vase here or straightening a flower there, and thus transforming it from a house to a home. Even now, after 7 years of marriage, she liked to picture herself in the gracious act. But, though she conscientiously made a try at it every night, as soon as the rose-shaded lamps were lit, she was always a bit bewildered as to how one went about performing those tiny miracles that make all the difference in the world to a room. Touch-giving was a wife's job, and Mrs. Weldon was not one to shirk the business she had entered. With an almost pitiable air of uncertainty, she strayed over to the mantel, lifted a small Japanese vase, and stood with it in her hand, gazing helplessly around the room. Then she stepped back and surveyed her innovations. It was amazing how little difference they made to the room. Note, too bad. The wife wastes a great deal of time and effort searching for originality or her individual perfection. This gives her work the characteristic of a meticulous and disordered task, with neither stops nor limits. As Chardin points out, which makes it so difficult to measure the burden that household cares really mean. According to a recent report, published in 1947 by the newspaper Combat, written by C. Hébert, married women devote about 3 hours and 45 minutes to housework, cleaning, food shopping, and so on, each working day, and 8 hours on the day of rest. That is 30 hours a week, which corresponds to 3/4 of the working week of a woman worker or employee. This is enormous if it is added to a paid job. It is not much if the wife has nothing else to do, especially as woman workers and employees lose time traveling that has no equivalent here. Caring for children, if there are many, considerably adds to the wife's fatigue. A poor mother depletes her strength every one of her hectic days. By contrast, bourgeois women who have help are almost idle, and the ransom of this leisure is boredom. Because they are bored, many complicate and endlessly multiply their duties so that they become more stressful than a skilled job. A woman friend who had gone through nervous breakdowns told me that when she was in good health, she took care of her house almost without thinking of it, leaving her time for much more challenging occupations. When neurasthenia prevented her from giving herself to other jobs, she allowed herself to be swallowed up by household cares, devoting whole days to them without managing to finish. The saddest thing is that this work does not even result in a lasting creation. Woman is tempted, all the more as she is so attentive to it, to consider her work as an end in itself. Contemplating the cake she takes out of the oven, she sighs, "What a pity to eat it. What a pity husband and children drag their muddy feet on the waxed floor." As soon as things are used, they are dirtied or destroyed. She is tempted, as we have already seen, to withdraw them from being used. She keeps the jam until mold invades it. She locks the living room doors. But time cannot be stopped. Supplies attract rats. Worms start their work. Covers, curtains, and clothes are eaten by moths. The world is not a dream carved in stone. It is made of a suspicious-looking substance threatened by decomposition. Edible stuff is as questionable as Dalí's meat monsters. It seemed inert and inorganic, but hidden larvae have metamorphosed it into corpses. The housewife who alienates herself in things depends, like things, on the whole world. Linens turn gray, the roast burns, china breaks. These are absolute disasters because when things disappear, they disappear irremediably. It is impossible to obtain permanence and security through them. Wars, with their looting and bombs, threaten wardrobes and the home. Thus, the product of housework has to be consumed. Constant renunciation is demanded of the wife, whose work is finished only with its destruction. For her to consent to it without regret, these small holocausts must spark some joy or pleasure somewhere. But as housework is spent in maintaining the status quo, the husband, when he comes home, notices disorder and negligence, but takes order and neatness for granted. He attaches more positive importance to a well-prepared meal. The triumphant moment of the cook is when she places a successful dish on the table. Husband and children welcome it warmly, not only with words, but also by consuming it joyously. Culinary alchemy continues with the food becoming chyle and blood. Taking care of a body is of more concrete interest, is more vital than care of a parquet floor. The cook's effort transcends toward the future in an obvious way. However, while it is less futile to depend on an outside freedom than to alienate oneself in things, it is no less dangerous. It is only in the guests' mouths that the cook's work finds its truth. She needs their approval. She demands that they appreciate her dishes, that they take more. She is irritated if they are no longer hungry, to the point that one does not know if the fried potatoes are destined for the husband or the husband for the fried potatoes. This ambiguity is found in the housewife's whole attitude. She keeps the house for her husband, but she also insists on his devoting all the money he earns to buying furniture or a refrigerator. She wants to make him happy, but she approves of his activities only if they fit into the framework of the happiness she has constructed. There have been periods when these claims were generally satisfied, periods when happiness was also the man's ideal, when he was primarily attached to his house and family, and when the children themselves chose to define themselves by family, their traditions, and their past. Then she who ruled the home, who presided over the table, was recognized as sovereign. She still plays this glorious role as wife in relation to some landowners, or some rich farmers who occasionally still perpetuate the patriarchal civilization. But on the whole, marriage today is the survival of obsolete customs, with the wife's situation much more thankless than before, since she still has the same duties, while these no longer confer the same rights. She has the same chores, without the rewards or honor from doing them. Today, man marries to anchor himself in imminence, but not to confine himself in it. He wants a home, but also to remain free to escape from it. He settles down, but he often remains a vagabond in his heart. He does not scorn happiness, but he does not make it an end in itself. Repetition bores him. He seeks novelty, risk, resistance to overcome, camaraderie, friendships that wrest him from the solitude of the couple. Children, even more than husbands, want to go beyond the home's limits. Their life is elsewhere, in front of them. The child always desires what is other. The wife tries to constitute a universe of permanence and continuity. Husband and children want to go beyond the situation she creates, and which for them is only a given. Thus, if she is loath to admit the precariousness of the activities to which her whole life is devoted, she is led to impose her services by force. From mother and housewife, she becomes cruel mother and shrew. So, the wife's work within the home does not grant her autonomy. It is not directly useful to the group. It does not open on to the future. It does not produce anything. It becomes meaningful and dignified only if it is integrated into existences that go beyond themselves, toward the society in production or action. Far from enfranchising the matron, it makes her dependent on her husband and children. She justifies her existence through them. She is no more than an inessential mediation in their lives. That the civil code erased obedience from her duties changes nothing in her situation. Her situation is not based on what the couple wants, but on the very structure of the conjugal community. The wife is not allowed to do any positive work, and consequently, to have herself known as a complete person. Regardless of how well she is respected, she is subjugated, secondary, parasitic. The heavy curse weighing on her is that the very meaning of her existence is not in her hands. This is the reason the successes and failures of her conjugal life have much more importance for her than for the man. He is a citizen, a producer, before being a husband. She is above all and often exclusively a wife. Her work does not extract her from her condition. It is from her condition, on the contrary, that her work derives its price or not. Loving, generously devoted, she will carry out her tasks joyously. These chores will seem insipid to her if she accomplishes them with resentment. They will never play more than an inessential role in her destiny. In the misadventures of conjugal life, they will be of no help. We thus have to see how this condition is concretely lived, one that is essentially defined by bed service and housework service, in which the wife finds her dignity only in accepting her vassalage. It is a crisis that pushes the young girl from childhood to adolescence. An even more acute crisis thrusts her into adult life. The anxieties inherent in all passages from one condition to another are superimposed on those that a somewhat brusque sexual initiation provokes in a woman. Nietzsche writes, "And then to be hurled, as by a gruesome lightning bolt into reality and knowledge by marriage, to catch love and shame in a contradiction, and to be forced to experience at the same time delight, surrender, duty, pity, terror, and who knows what else, in the face of the unexpected neighborliness of God and beast. Thus a psychic knot has been tied that may have no equal. Note, The Gay Science, Translation. The excitement that surrounded the traditional honeymoon was meant in part to hide this confusion. Thrown outside her everyday world for a few weeks, all connections with society being temporarily broken, the young woman was no longer situated in space, in time, in reality. Note, fantasy ecle literature often has defloration take place in the sleeping car, which is a way of placing it nowhere. But sooner or later, she has to take her place there again, and she finds herself in her new home, but never without apprehension. Her ties with her father's home are much stronger than her ties with the young man's. Tearing oneself away from one's family is a definitive weaning. This is when she experiences the anguish of abandon and the giddiness of freedom. The break is more or less painful, depending on the case. If she has already broken the ties connecting her to her father, brothers, and sisters, and above all her mother, she can leave painlessly. If still dominated by them, she can practically remain in their protection, she will be less affected by her change in condition. But ordinarily, even if she wanted to escape from the paternal household, she feels disconcerted when she is separated from the little society in which she was integrated, cut off from her past, her child's universe with its familiar principles and unquestioned values. Only an ardent and full erotic life could make her bathe again in the peace of imminence. But usually she is at first more upset than fulfilled. That sexual initiation is more or less successful simply adds to her confusion. The day after her wedding finds many of the same reactions she had on her first menstruation. She often experiences disgust at this supreme revelation of her femininity, horror at the idea that this experience will be renewed. She also feels the bitter disappointment of the day after. Once she began menstruating, the girl sadly realized she was not an adult. Deflowered, now the young woman is an adult, and the last step is taken. Now what? This worrying disappointment is moreover linked as much to marriage itself as it is to defloration. A woman who had already known her fiancé or who had known other men, but for whom marriage represents the full accession to adult life, will often have the same reaction. Living the beginning of an enterprise is exalting, but nothing is more depressing than discovering a destiny over which one no longer has a hold. From this definitive, immutable background, freedom emerges with the most intolerable gratuitousness. Previously, the girl, sheltered by her parents' authority, made use of her freedom in revolt and hope. She used it to refuse and go beyond a condition in which she nevertheless found security. Her own transcendence toward marriage took place from within the warmth of the family. Now she is married. There is no other future in front of her. The doors of home are closed around her. Of all the earth, this will be her portion. She knows exactly what tasks lie ahead of her, the same as her mother's. Day after day, the same rites will be repeated. When she was a girl, her hands were empty. In hope, in dreams, she possessed everything. Now she has acquired a share of the world, and she thinks in anguish, there is nothing more than this, forever. Forever, this husband, this home. She has nothing more to expect, nothing more to want. However, she is afraid of her new responsibilities. Even if her husband is older and has authority, the fact that she has sexual relations with him removes some of his prestige. He cannot replace a father, and even less a mother. And he cannot give her her freedom. In the solitude of the new home, tied to a man who is more or less a stranger, no longer child, but wife, and destined to become mother in turn, she feels numb. definitively removed from her mother's breast, lost in the middle of a world to which no aim calls her, abandoned in an icy present, she discovers the boredom and blandness of pure facticity. This is the distress so stunningly expressed in the young Countess Tolstoy's diary. Note, Diaries of Sophia Tolstoy, translation. She enthusiastically gave her hand to the great writer she admired, after the passionate embraces she submitted to on the wooden balcony at Yasnaya Polyana. She found herself disgusted by carnal love, far from her family, cut off from her past, at the side of a man to whom she had been engaged for 1 week, someone who was 17 years her senior, with a totally foreign past and interests. Everything seems empty, icy to her. Her life is no more than an eternal sleep. Her diary account of the first years of her marriage must be quoted. On September 23, 1862, Sophia gets married and leaves her family in the evening. A difficult and painful feeling gripped my throat and held me tight. I then felt that the time had come to leave forever my family and all those I loved deeply and with whom I had always lived. The farewells began and were ghastly. Now the last minutes. I had intentionally reserved the farewells to my mother till the end, when I pulled myself from her embrace and without turning around, I went to take my place in the car. She uttered a heart-rending cry I have never forgotten all my life. Autumn rain did not cease to fall. Huddled in my corner, overwhelmed with fatigue and sorrow, I let my tears flow. Leon Nikolaevich seemed very surprised, even discontent. When we left the city, I felt in the depths a sentiment of fear. The darkness oppressed me. We barely said anything to each other until the first stop, Biryulev, if I am not mistaken. I remember that Leon Nikolaevich was very tender and attentive to my every need. At Biryulev, we were given the rooms said to be for the Tsar, big rooms with furniture upholstered in red rep that was not very welcoming. We were brought the samovar. Cuddled up in a corner of the couch, I kept silent as a condemned person. Well, said Leon Nikolaevich to me, if you did the honors. I obeyed and served the tea. I was upset and could not free myself from a kind of fear. I did not dare address Leon Nikolaevich in the familiar form and avoided calling him by his name. For a long time I continued to use the formal form. 24 hours later, they arrive at Yasnaya Polyana. She resumes her diary again on October 8th. She feels anxious. She suffers from the fact that her husband has a past. I always dreamt of the man I would love as a completely whole, new, pure person. In these childish dreams, which I still find hard to give up, when he kisses me, I am always thinking, I am not the first woman he has loved. The following day, she notes, I feel downcast all the same. I had such a depressing dream last night, and it is weighing on me, although I do not remember it in detail. I thought of Mama today and grew dreadfully sad. I seem to be asleep all the time and unable to wake up. Something is weighing on me. I keep thinking that at any moment I might die. It is so strange to be thinking such things now that I have a husband. I can hear him in there sleeping. I am frightened of being on my own. He will not let me go into his room, which makes me very sad. All physical things disgust him. October 11th. I am terribly, terribly sad, and withdrawing further and further into myself. My husband is ill and out of sorts and doesn't love me. I expected this, yet I could never have imagined it would be so terrible. Why do people always think I am so happy? What no one seems to realize is that I cannot create happiness either for him or for myself. Before, when I was feeling miserable, I would ask myself, what is the use of living when you make others unhappy and yourself wretched? This thought keeps recurring to me now, and I am terrified. He grows colder and colder every day, while I, on the contrary, love him more and more. I keep thinking of my own family and how happy my life was with them. Now, my God, it breaks my heart to think that nobody loves me. Darling mother, Tanya, what wonderful people they were. Why did I ever leave them? It gnaws at my conscience. Lyubotchka is a wonderful man. Now I have lost everything I once possessed. All my energy for work, life, and household tasks has been wasted. Now I want only to sit in silence all day, doing nothing but think bitter thoughts. I wanted to do some work, but could not. I longed to play the piano, but it is so awkward in this place. He suggested today that I stay at home while he went off to Nikolskoye. I should have agreed and set him free from my presence, but I simply could not. Poor man. He is always looking for something to divert him and take him away from me. What is the point of living? November 13th. It is true. I cannot find anything to occupy me. He is fortunate because he is talented and clever. I am neither. It is not difficult to find work. There is plenty to do. But first you have to enjoy such petty household tasks as breeding hens, tinkling on the piano, reading a lot of fourth-rate books and precious good ones, and pickling cucumbers. I am asleep now, since nothing brings me any excitement or joy, neither the trip to Moscow nor the thought of the baby. I wish I could take some remedy to refresh me and wake me up. It is terrible to be alone. I am not used to it. There was so much life and love at home, and it's so lifeless here without him. He is almost always on his own. He finds pleasure not in the company of those close to him, as I do, but in his work. He never had a family. November 23rd. Of course, I am idle at present, but I am not so by nature. I simply have not discovered anything I could do. Sometimes I long to break free of his rather oppressive influence and stop worrying about him, but I cannot. I find his influence oppressive because I have begun thinking his thoughts and seeing with his eyes, trying to become like him, and losing myself. And I have changed too, which makes it even harder for me. April 1st. I have a very great misfortune. I have no inner resources to draw on. Lyova has his work and the estate to think about, while I have nothing. What am I good for? I would like to do more, something real. At this wonderful time of year, I always used to long for things, aspire to things, dream about God knows what. But I no longer need anything, no longer have those foolish aspirations, for I know instinctively that I have all I need now, and there is nothing left to strive for. Everything seems stupid now, and I get irritable. April 20th. Lyova ignores me more and more. The physical side of love is very important for him. This is terrible. For me, it is quite the opposite. Note: discrepancy between the French and the English translations. In the English text of Tolstoy's diary, the date is given as April 29th. Translation. It is clear during these first 6 months that the young woman is suffering from her separation from her family, from solitude, and from the definitive turn her destiny has taken. She detests her physical relations with her husband, and she is bored. This is the same ennui Colette's mother feels to the point of tears after the first marriage her brothers imposed on her. So she left the cozy Belgian house, the cellar kitchen that smelled of gas, warm bread, and coffee. She left her piano, her violin, the big Salvatore Rosa she had inherited from her father, the tobacco jar and the fine long-stemmed clay pipes, the coke braziers, the books that lay open and the crumpled newspapers, and as a new bride entered the house with its flight of steps, isolated by the harsh winter of the forest lands all around. Here she found, to her surprise, a white and gold living room on the ground floor, but a first floor with barely even rough-cast walls as abandoned as a loft. The bedrooms were icy cold and prompted no thoughts of either love or sweet sleep. Sido, who longed for friends and an innocent and cheerful social life, found on her estate only servants, cunning farmers. She filled the big house with flowers, had the dark kitchen whitewashed, oversaw in person the preparation of the Flemish dishes, kneaded cakes with raisins, and looked forward to having her first child. The savage would smile at her between two outings, and then set off once more. When she had exhausted her tasty recipes, her patience, and her furniture polish, Sido, who had grown thin with loneliness, started to cry. Note, Claudine's house. In Lettre à Françoise Mariée, Letters to Françoise, Married, Marcel Prévost describes the young woman's dismay upon her return from her honeymoon. She thinks of her mother's apartment with its Napoleon III and McMahon furniture, its plush velvet, its wardrobes and black plum wood, everything she judged so old-fashioned, so ridiculous. In one instant, all of that is evoked in her memory as a real haven, a true nest. The nest where she was watched over with disinterested tenderness, sheltered from all storms and danger. This apartment with its new carpet smell, its unadorned windows, the chairs in disarray, its whole air of improvisation and haste. No, it is not a nest. It is only the place of the nest that has to be built. She suddenly felt horribly sad, as if she had been abandoned in a desert. This distress is what often causes long depressions and various psychoses in the young woman. In particular, in the guise of different psychasthenic obsessions, she feels the giddiness of her empty freedom. She develops, for example, fantasies of prostitution we have already seen in young girls. Pierre Janet cites the case of a young bride who could not stand being alone in her apartment because she was tempted to go to the window and wink at passers-by. Note, obsessions and psychasthenia. Others remain ebullient-faced with a universe that no longer seems real, peopled only with ghosts and painted cardboard sets. There are those who try to refuse their adulthood, who will obstinately persist in refusing it their whole lives, like another patient whom Janet designates with the initials QI. QI, a 36-year-old woman, is obsessed by the idea that she is a little 10 to 12-year-old girl, especially when she is alone. She lets herself jump, laugh, dance. She lets her hair down, lets it loose on her shoulders, sometimes cuts it in places. She would like to lose herself completely in this dream of being a child. It is so unfortunate that she cannot play hide-and-seek, play tricks in front of everyone. I would like people to think I am nice. I am afraid of being the ugly duckling. I would like to be liked, talked to, petted, to be constantly told that I am loved as one loves little children. A child is loved for his mischievousness, for his good little heart, for his kindness, and what is asked of him in return? To love you, nothing more. That is what is good, but I cannot say that to my husband. He would not understand me. Look, I would so much like to be a little girl, have a father or a mother who would take me on their lap, caress my hair. But no, I am a madame, a mother. I have to keep the home, be serious, think on my own. Oh, what a life! Marriage is often a crisis for man as well. The proof is that many masculine psychoses develop during the engagement period or the early period of conjugal life. Less attached to his family than his sisters are, the young man belongs to some group, a special school, a university, a guild, a team, something that protects him from loneliness. He leaves it behind to begin his real existence as an adult. He is apprehensive of his future solitude, and it is often to exercise it that he gets married. But he is fooled by the illusion maintained by the whole community that depicts the couple as a conjugal society. Except in the brief fire of a passionate affair, two individuals cannot form a world that protects each of them against the world. This is what they both feel the day after the wedding. The wife, soon familiar, subjugated, does not obstruct her husband's freedom. She is a burden, not an alibi. She does not free him from the weight of his responsibilities, but on the contrary, she exacerbates them. The difference of the sexes often means differences in age, education, and situation that do not bring about any real understanding. Familiar, the spouses are still strangers. Previously, there was often a real chasm between them. The young girl, raised in a state of ignorance and innocence, had no past, while her fiancé had lived. It was up to him to initiate her into the reality of life. Some males feel flattered by this delicate role. More lucid, they warily measure the distance that separates them from their future companion. In her novel, The Age of Innocence, Edith Wharton describes the scruples of a young American of 1870 concerning the woman destined for him. With a new sense of awe, he looked at the frank forehead, serious eyes, and gay, innocent mouth of the young creature whose soul's custodian he was to be. That terrifying product of the social system he belonged to and believed in, the young girl who knew nothing and expected everything, looked back at him like a stranger. What could he and she really know of each other, since it was his duty as a decent fellow to conceal his past from her, and hers, as a marriageable girl, to have no past to conceal? The young girl who was the center of this elaborate system of mystification remained the more inscrutable for her very frankness and assurance. She was frank, poor darling, because she had nothing to conceal, assured because she knew of nothing to be on her guard against, and with no better preparation than this, she was to be plunged overnight into what people evasively called the facts of life. But when he had gone the brief round of her, he returned discouraged by the thought that all this frankness and innocence were only an artificial product, so cunningly manufactured by a conspiracy of mothers and aunts and grandmothers and long-dead ancestresses, because it was supposed to be what he wanted, what he had a right to, in order that he might exercise his lordly pleasure in smashing it like an image made of snow. Today, the gap is not as wide because the young girl is a less artificial being. She is better informed, better armed for life, but she is often much younger than her husband. The importance of this point has not been emphasized enough. The consequences of an unequal maturity are often taken as differences of sex. In many cases, the wife is a child, not because she is a woman, but because she is in fact very young. The seriousness of her husband and his friends overwhelms her. Sophia Tolstoy wrote about 1 year after her wedding day, "He is old and self-absorbed, whereas I feel young and long to do something wild. I'd like to turn somersaults instead of going to bed. But with whom? Old age hovers over me. Everything here is old. I try to suppress all youthful feelings, for they would seem odd and out of place in this somber environment." Note, Diaries of Sophia Tolstoy, December 19, 1863, translation. As for the husband, he sees a baby in his wife. For him, she is not the companion he expected, and he makes her feel it. She is humiliated by it. No doubt she likes finding a guide when she leaves her father's home, but she also wants to be seen as a grown-up. She wants to remain a child. She wants to become a woman. Her older spouse can never treat her in a way that totally satisfies her. Even if their age difference is slight, the fact remains that the young woman and young man have generally been brought up very differently. She is the product of a feminine universe where she was inculcated with feminine sagacity and respect for feminine values, whereas he is imbued with the male ethic. It is often very difficult for them to understand each other, and conflicts soon arise. Because marriage usually subordinates the wife to the husband, the intensity of the problem of conjugal relations rests mainly on her. The paradox of marriage is that it brings into play an erotic function as well as a social one. This ambivalence is reflected in the figure the husband presents to the young wife. He is a demigod, endowed with virile prestige and destined to replace her father. Protector, overseer, tutor, guide. The wife has to thrive in his shadow. He is the holder of values, the guarantor of truth, the ethical justification of the couple. But he is also a male with whom she must share an experience often shameful, bizarre, disgusting, or upsetting, and in any case, contingent. He invites his wife to wallow with him in bestiality while directing her with a strong hand toward the ideal. One night in Paris, where they had come on their return journey, Bernard made a show of walking out of a nightclub, shocked at the review. "To think that foreign visitors will see that! What shame! And that's how they'll judge us!" Thérèse could only marvel that this so chaste man was the same one who would be making her submit, in less than an hour, to his patient inventions in the dark. Note, Mauriac, Thérèse d'Esqueroux. There are many hybrid forms between mentor and beast. Sometimes man is at once father and lover. The sexual act becomes a sacred orgy, and the loving wife finds ultimate salvation in the arms of her husband, redeemed by total abdication. This love passion within married life is very rare, and at times the wife will love her husband platonically, but will be unable to abandon herself in the arms of a man she respects too much. Such is this woman, whose case Stekel reports. Mrs. D.S., a great artist's widow, is now 40 years old. Although she adored her husband, she was completely frigid with him. On the contrary, she may experience pleasure with him that she suffers as a common disgrace, killing all respect and esteem she has for him. Besides, an erotic failure relegates her husband to the ranks of a brute. Hated in his flesh, he will be reviled in spirit. Inversely, we have seen how scorn, antipathy, and rancor doomed the wife to frigidity. What often happens is that the husband remains a respected superior being after the sexual experience. Excused of his animalistic weaknesses, it seems that this was the case, among others, of Adele Hugo. Or else he is a pleasant partner without prestige. Catherine Mansfield described one of the forms this ambivalence can take in her short story, Prelude. For she was really fond of him. She loved and admired and respected him tremendously. Oh, better than anyone else in the world. She knew him through and through. He was the soul of truth and decency, and for all his practical experience, he was awfully simple, easily pleased and easily hurt. If only he wouldn't jump at her so, and bark so loudly, and watch her with such eager, loving eyes. He was too strong for her. She had always hated things that rushed at her from a child. There were times when he was frightening, really frightening, when she just had not screamed at the top of her voice, "You are killing me!" And at those times, she had longed to say the most coarse, hateful things. Yes, yes, it was true. For all her love and respect and admiration, she hated him. It had never been so plain to her as it was at this moment. There were all her feelings for him, sharp and defined, one as true as the other. And there was this other, this hatred, just as real as the rest. She could have done her feelings up in little packets and given them to Stanley. She longed to hand him that last one for a surprise. She could see his eyes as he opened that. The young wife rarely admits her feelings to herself with such sincerity. To love her husband and to be happy is a duty to herself and society. This is what her family expects of her. Or if her parents were against the marriage, she wants to prove how wrong they were. She usually begins her conjugal life in bad faith. She easily persuades herself that she feels great love for her husband, and this passion takes on a more manic, possessive, and jealous form the less sexually satisfied she is. To console herself for this disappointment that she refuses at first to admit, she has an insatiable need for her husband's presence. Stekel cites numerous examples of these pathological attachments. A woman remained frigid for the first years of her marriage due to childhood fixations. She then developed a hypertrophic love, as is frequently found in women who cannot bear to see that their husbands are indifferent to them. She lived only for her husband and thought only of him. She lost all will. He had to plan her day every morning, tell her what to buy, etc. She carried out everything conscientiously. If he did not tell her what to do, she stayed in her room doing nothing and worried about him. She could not let him go anywhere without accompanying him. She could not stay alone, and she liked to hold his hand. She was unhappy and cried for hours, trembling for her husband, and if there were no reasons to tremble, she created them. My second case concerned a woman closed up in her room as if it were a prison for fear of going out alone. I found her holding her husband's hands, pleading with him to stay near her. Married for 7 years, he was never able to have relations with his wife. Sophia Tolstoy's case was similar. It comes out clearly in the passage I have cited, and all throughout her diaries, that as soon as she was married, she realized she did not love her husband. Sexual relations with him disgusted her. She reproached him for his past, found him old and boring, had nothing but hostility for his ideas, and it seems that, greedy and brutal in bed, he neglected her and treated her harshly. To her hopeless cries, her confessions of ennui, sadness, and indifference, were nevertheless added Sophia's protestations of passionate love. She wanted her beloved husband near her always. As soon as he was away from her, she was tortured with jealousy. She writes, January 11th, 1863. My jealousy is a congenital illness, or it may be because in loving him I have nothing else to love. I have given myself so completely to him that my only happiness is with him and from him. January 15th, 1863. Note, Diaries of Sophia Tolstoy. Discrepancy between the French and the English translations. In the English text, the date is given as January 17th. Translation. I have been feeling out of sorts and angry that he should love everything and everyone when I want him to love only me. The moment I think fondly of something or someone, I tell myself no, I love only Lyubotchka. But I absolutely must learn to love something else as he loves his work. But I hate being alone without him. My need to be near him grows stronger every day. October 17, 1863. I feel I don't understand him properly. That's why I am always jealously following him. July 31, 1868. It makes me laugh to read my diary. What a lot of contradictions, as though I were the unhappiest of women. Could any marriage be more happy and harmonious than ours? I have been married 6 years now, but I love him more and more. I still love him with the same passionate, poetic, fevered, jealous love, and his composure occasionally irritates me. September 16, 1876. Note, discrepancy between the French and the English translations. In the English text, the date is given as September 17th. Translation. I avidly search his diaries for any reference to love, and am so tormented by jealousy that I can no longer see anything clearly. I am afraid of my resentment of Lyubotchka for leaving me. I choke back the tears, or hide away several times a day and weep with anxiety. I have a fever every day and a chill at night. What is he punishing me for? I keep asking myself. Why? For loving him so much. These pages convey the feeling of a vain effort to compensate for the absence of a real love with moral and poetic exaltation. Demands, anxieties, jealousy are expressions of the emptiness in her heart. A great deal of morbid jealousy develops in such conditions. In an indirect way, jealousy conveys a dissatisfaction that woman objectifies by inventing a rival. Never feeling fulfillment with her husband, she rationalizes in some way her disappointment by imagining him deceiving her. Very often, the wife persists in her pretense through morality, hypocrisy, pride, or timidity. Often an aversion for the dear husband will go unnoticed for a whole life, It is called melancholia, or some other name, says Chardon. Note, Ava. But the hostility is no less felt, even though it is not named. It is expressed with more or less violence in the young wife's effort to refuse her husband's domination. After the honeymoon and the period of confusion that often follows, she tries to win back her autonomy. This is not an easy undertaking. The fact that her husband is often older than she is, that he possesses, in any case, masculine prestige, and that he is the head of the family according to the law, means he bears moral and social superiority. Very often he also possesses, or at least appears to, an intellectual superiority. He has the advantage of culture, or at least professional training, over his wife. Since adolescence, he has been interested in world affairs. They are his affairs. He knows a little law. He follows politics. He belongs to a party, a union, clubs. Worker and citizen, his thinking is connected to action. He knows that one cannot cheat reality. That is, the average man has the technique of reasoning, the taste for facts and experience, a certain critical sense. Here is what many girls lack. Even if they have read, listened to lectures, touched upon the fine arts, their knowledge amassed here and there does not constitute culture. It is not because of an intellectual defect that they have not learned to reason. It is because they have not had to practice it. For them, thinking is more of a game than an instrument. Lacking intellectual training, even intelligent, sensitive, and sincere women do not know how to present their opinions and draw conclusions from them. That is why a husband, even if far more mediocre, will easily take the lead over them. He knows how to prove himself right, even if he is wrong. Logic in masculine hands is often violence. Chardon explained this kind of sly oppression well in Epithalamium. Older, more cultivated, and more educated than Bertha, Albert uses this pretext to deny any value to opinions of his wife that he does not share. He untiringly proves he is right. For her part, she becomes adamant and refuses to accept that there is any substance in her husband's reasoning. He persists in his ideas, and that is the end of it. Thus, a serious misunderstanding deepens between them.